From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how Indigenous Peoples Day came to be recognized in Wisconsin. Then we'll talk with a member of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective about the history of Cubans in Milwaukee.
100 to 200 families settled in the Milwaukee area. In fact, like 81 Cubans arrived on a National Airlines charter flight to Mitchell Field in June of 1962.
We'll learn about Take Root Milwaukee, a group helping non-native English speakers become homeowners.
Our agencies have bilingual, multilingual staff members that can help people who have questions, who have doubts. Because of the language barrier, there seems to be a little bit of a trust issue. It is important for us to be able to get the word across.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. Since 2019, every second Monday of October is officially recognized as Indigenous Peoples Day in Wisconsin. That's all thanks to a group of students at Indian Community School in Franklin. In 2016, a group of fourth graders were learning about Columbus Day, and something didn't sit right with them. This led to some classroom discussions, which grew into a Milwaukee County resolution, a rally at the state capitol in Madison, and eventually statewide approval of Indigenous Peoples Day. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Jason Dropic, the head of Indian Community School, and Siobhan Marks, the school's communications and marketing director.
Here at the Indian Community School, we really try to make sure that our students have a solid understanding of a true history, and in particular, in what is now Wisconsin and in the lands that we call Turtle Island here in North America, there's often untold stories. And our fourth graders have really done a lot of work historically about having a clearer understanding of history and what has happened. And our students heard a story of Columbus and his discovery of land where ancestors that had been here thriving and doing well together. They had been taught that for as long as I can remember here at the school. We really try to make sure that we continue to expose our students to all perspectives, as many as we possibly can. But they were really moved by what they were learning. And in particular, what they felt is that they wanted to take action. It's not only just knowing that they weren't always told a complete story of what had happened, and in particular, all the different dynamics that existed between through exploration and colonization, but all these impacts on communities, but they really wanted to make sure that other people were aware of it as well. And so that fourth grade group not only learned about it, but they wanted to take action. So they were curious and they asked their teachers, how do we get more people to understand more of different perspectives and the stories that are untold? How do we help share that with others? And through their teacher and working with the students, they were able to identify, we could create a proclamation. Other communities had done that, and there is a process by which that takes place. And the students were all about it. They're like, yes, let's do that. And they researched, they crafted, they rewrote, they had edits, and then they ended up going into the Milwaukee County Supervisors Committee work. That was brought forth from the committee to go to the full County Supervisor Board and be able to discuss and create this proclamation for Milwaukee County to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day. So they were able to take that action, do the research, bring it forth, speak in front of others, and all the way down to City Hall, and to be able to go with those fourth grade students, to be able to present what they were looking to change in their community and in their area, opening the proceedings in Ojibwe with a prayer, having our drum there present so the students, their identities were really supportive, and then advocating for their beliefs. And then it got voted on and it got passed Milwaukee County. Those fourth graders saw the whole process through. So it was an amazing testament to students really trying to be not only knowledgeable, but then also enacting change, being able to help support others and just share with others. That was really what they wanted to do. They believe that, their ancestors and their communities and our cultures are not just historical, that they're valid today, and we need to really continue to teach them. And they wanted to take that action so that other people would recognize that and realize that.
The students kept this momentum going beyond the county declaration in 2016. Can you go into a bit about the rally in 2017 that was, in fact, at the state capitol in support of a bill to declare the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day?
Yes, absolutely. So we were, that work in Milwaukee County to be recognized, that was a great first step. And our students really knew that it wasn't done. And though that work was gratifying and it was great for them to be able to be recognized and to see that, they still knew that the rest of our state didn't have the same recognition. And so we were, you know, very fortunate to continue to be connected to individuals in legislation. At that time, Milwaukee Representative David Bowen helped to support a bill to declare the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day statewide. And he had met with the students and talked with them about the legislative process at the state level. And then our students were able to travel to the state capitol to be able to testify in front of the news was there, as well as other legislators, and to continue to speak and advocate for Indigenous Peoples Day so that we could expand it statewide so that all communities would be able to understand the work that our students had done, as well as acknowledge the many tribes and students and communities that exist in Wisconsin. And so our fourth grade students at that time were fifth graders, and they're going to the Capitol and taking other students with them, students to help testify and to share their perspective. As they took that on, we wanted to continue to make sure that we were acknowledging and celebrating. And though at that time that legislation didn't get taken forward, you know, it was really important that our students had that opportunity to share their perspective, to be able to come together, to voice what they wished that the entire state would recognize. What it also taught our students, and I felt that even though it didn't get taken up that year, I think it's a really important process, part of the process for our students to realize it doesn't always just go exactly as you plan. It doesn't happen overnight. Like our ancestors and our communities have been really advocating for rights for a long time. And our students to be able to realize that, yep, it didn't go the way that we wanted to this time, but we're going to continue to voice what we believe is right and continue to share with others. I thought that that was a really important part of the process too that year.
Siobhan, you were there as well. What part of that experience at the Capitol with the students stands out to you?
Jason is a tremendous speaker, and he uses his gifts really well for us. And so we're really fortunate. Just listening to him tell that story was taking me back to that time. I think one of my most sincere memories of the rally in Madison was seeing the community and the families come out in support of the students. Not only during their testimony, but following their testimony, we all got in the rotunda and we have these amazing photos, but our drum and our singers were there singing and filling the halls of our state capitol with our songs in our way. And we did a round dance all around that rotunda with the students. So there's some really great images and certainly embedded in my heart from that day. So that was one of my fondest memories, was seeing our community rally around their children.
Well, then we can fast forward to 2019, and there was statewide recognition finally accomplished by Governor Tony Evers, who in fact came back to the school to sign the bill. So what were some of the emotions from both students and teachers in the wider community felt that day?
It was a shock. You know, it's not often that the governor calls you up or his people and say, hey, we're going to really would like to come to your school and we're going to sign an executive order and we want to acknowledge the work that your students had done. That doesn't happen every day. It's happened once in my career in administration. But to have that opportunity, the governor's office had reached out and they were explaining what they wanted to do, wanted to be able to acknowledge the students' work, but really also acknowledge our communities. And it was really that acknowledgement of contributions that tribal communities have had in this state for as long as can be remembered. That was really powerful, impactful. And the fact that the governor wanted to sign that order here at our school with our students based on, you know, recognition of the work that they had done, it filled my heart that day for sure, because I know that that's not something that happens for every student and every community. And I know that for many tribal communities in particular, sometimes that never happens. And so to be able to have our students see that and have tribal leaders here in the audience with our students and to have the governor of our state be able to acknowledge their hard work and really acknowledge them as people and contributing members of a community, It was very powerful. It really meant a lot to us as a community and a school.
Even though these major things were accomplished, right, and such historical moments for students and everyone to be a part of, it's still very recent history. So why is it important to continue to share this legacy that was built by your students and to continue this memory in your new students who are now a part of the school's legacy as well?
Yeah, that's a great point. And that idea of, you know, what we try to teach within our students is really understanding, you know, that work always continues. And, you know, that opportunity for learning and growth doesn't stop. And we know that, and we have seen even in our state's recent experiences too, where there's still a lack of knowledge. There's communities that have had some missteps that have really brought negative light to their communities, non-tribal communities, who would, you know, through lack of education and knowledge, you know, different ways that they have just appropriated ways of being that aren't respectful to tribal nations and a sense of identity. And so I think that, you know, it's important for us to continue to make sure that our students, one, know that they have to be those knowledge keepers. They have a responsibility, and we're taught that. Our elders teach us about responsibilities that we have to all of creation. So that includes people that were related to the land and the water and the animals. All of those responsibilities are really important to our communities. And so we try to teach our students to make sure that, you know, for both Native and non-Native alike, you know, they have a responsibility to continue that education, continue to raise capacity within our community, because it's through that engagement with others that we'll really be able to build an empathetic society of understanding so that we can all thrive, so that we can all flourish. And that's really what we want. We want communities to continue to learn more, so that they know better and can do better, as well as that our students can feel supported so that they don't have to face many of the stereotypes and the discrimination that, you know, those that came before them have faced, and that unfortunately we still do face at times. And so it hasn't stopped. Our students still know that they have a job to do and a responsibility to continue to grow and to share with others and to make sure that they give what was also given to them. We take that responsibility seriously, and so do our students.
Siobhan, how do you reflect on each year's growth since that first year in 2014 with a group of fourth graders?
Well, I have a great sense of pride in our students, in and of our staff, our board, and our community who's really supported us. To us, each and every day is Indigenous Peoples Day here at Indian Community School. But it's a really big deal for us on that second Monday of October, because it is something that our students achieve. Just looking back and seeing their tremendous achievement and all that we've been able to accomplish together, it's a really beautiful thing. I think the other important lesson that we have, or at least that our children have been able to learn, is about truly what sovereignty means in terms of not only for our tribal nations, but personal sovereignty as well. And in the words of some of our youngest students, I actually jotted this down. They said, "You don't have to be a grown-up to create change." And that came out of our 10-year-old fourth grade students of Indian Community School. I'm so proud of them.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it at. So Siobhan and Jason, I want to thank you both so much for sharing this story with me. I know I'll think about those fourth graders every time this holiday rolls around, and I hope we've helped other people appreciate how it came to be in Wisconsin.
Miigwech, thank you so much for sharing their amazing story. We do appreciate it.
See you, Miigwech.
Siobhan Marks is the Communications and Marketing Director for Indian Community School. And Jason Dropic is the head of the school. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Right now, we'll hear the students from Indian Community School singing at the state capitol.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Emily Files. When you look at a map of Wisconsin, it's covered in names that remind us of the country's original inhabitants. Milwaukee, Wauwatosa, Waukesha, Kinnickinnick. Those are all words derived from Native American languages. Another is Oconomowoc, about 30 miles west of Milwaukee. This week's Bubbler Talk questioner, Jeff Diddle, lives there.
A couple dozen lakes, and some of them have English names like Pine Lake and Beaver Lake and whatnot, but some of them have really unique Native American names.
Such as Nagawicca, Okachi, and of course, Oconomowoc. Jeff says he's wondered for a while what they mean. So I asked two experts.
Gewednodin Dijnikas, Minnesota, and Donjaba, and the Kinomage Oma, Minowaking, Nongam. My name's Margaret Noden, and I am originally from Minnesota, but I teach here in the Milwaukee area. I live in Thiensville near Mequon and teach on campus at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Nishin Zimmerman Jr., Megani Dijnikas, Minowago, Yukinomage on the way day. Nishnabe, Gikno, Madi, Wagamagong, Migo, Ijitamagok, Benaswe, Oldenong, Minawago, Indidaoma, Mi, Thiensville, Migijin Kade, Jaganoshamong. My name is Michael Zimmerman, and I teach at the Indian Community School in Franklin, and I live in Thiensville.
Zimmerman is a member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi, and Noden is a descendant of the Lake Superior Chippewa. They both speak Anishinaabe Mowin, an umbrella term for closely connected Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Odawa languages. Today, Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribes. Noden says the oldest is the Menominee.
We have Ho-Chunk, Potawatomi, and Menominee as the primary stewards of the space that we're in now, but the Mohicans, the Oneida, other folks moved into the place later.
She says many of the place names in this area can be traced to Ojibwe words. Noden explains those names stuck because the Ojibwe tribes were heavily involved in mapping and trade with settlers beginning in the 1600s. But Noden says other tribes may have different definitions for certain names. Let's get back to the word our Bubbler Talk questioner was curious about, Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc means they are building dams, and it's referring to beavers.
Zimmerman explains the two other lake names Jeff Diddle wondered about.
Okachi means it is small, so it's talking about something being very small out that way. I don't like couldn't really say why it was given that name. The other word, Nagawicca, Nagawi is sand. Nagawicca means a lot of sand.
Diddle was most surprised by the meaning of Okachi.
I live right across street from Okachi Lake, and it's out of all the couple dozen lakes out here, it's one of the bigger ones. And for me to find out that it means small, I wonder what they're referring to.
And that's the question for many Native American place names. The literal meaning is one thing, the story behind it is another. Here's Margaret Noden.
Yeah, I always think it's interesting because you really can't tell whether it was a story they're trying to tell, an incident that happened there, a person who might have had that name, or that's how they describe the place. It's very hard to know what it might have been.
Noden and Zimmerman did not learn Anishinaabe Mowin growing up. They had to seek it out themselves as adults. Now they both teach Indigenous languages, Noden to college students and Zimmerman to elementary classes. Their students will know Anishinaabe Mowin beyond the names of streets, cities, and lakes.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series here on Lake Effect, and you can hear it every Monday at noon and 8 o'clock. At wuwm.com, you can find our previous episodes of Bubbler Talk, including the story behind two mysterious brick pillars and how animals get to the Milwaukee County Zoo. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we'll speak with a father-son duo keeping the tradition of Latin music alive in Wisconsin. But first, we'll hear from a member of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective about the history of Cubans in Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's Hispanic Heritage Month, which means we're celebrating the histories of Hispanic Milwaukeeans. More than 60 years ago, after the rise of the Castro Revolution, Cubans started to immigrate to Milwaukee in larger numbers. Since then, they've become an integral part of our city. From Marta Bianchini, the owner of Cubanitas, to Jose Delgado, who helped create the American Transmission Company, Cuban Milwaukeeans have been influential in our state's history. Raul Galvan is the manager of program production at Milwaukee PBS, and he's a part of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the legacies of Cuban Milwaukeeans.
The Latinx Collective is something that Tess Arenas began. She's a retired administrator, and she had just finished writing a book documenting histories, oral histories of Latino women. And so this is an opportunity to tell new stories, to document the entire history of the Latino population, which has been an integral part of Wisconsin for many years. I'm really excited because, you know, I'm a historian. I also teach at UWM. And I think it's going to be a worthwhile endeavor. All those stories I didn't tell you are going to be housed and curated at the Wisconsin Historical Society of Medicine.
And your main focus, your primary focus, is focusing on the histories of Cubans in Milwaukee. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of Cubans in Milwaukee?
I'd like to think that I'm sort of part of the history of Cubans in Milwaukee. I came in 1975, April, to work at the then Milwaukee Public TV. When I got here, there were scattered number of Cubans. The people that were there then were the remainder of the folks who had come in what is typically called the historic Cuban immigrants that left the island at the very beginning of the revolution. So those folks had come here basically like right in 1961, some even came before. It's estimated that 100 to 200 families settled in the Milwaukee area. In fact, like 81 Cubans arrived on a National Airlines charter flight to Mitchell Field in June of 1962. Most of these Cubans of the early batch that came were sponsored by churches, either Catholic churches and Catholic family movement groups within those churches, or Protestant churches. You know, the early group that came were most white. There were varying degrees of education, and they found jobs at area hospitals, factories, publishing houses, car dealers, and schools. And the thing that also happened in Milwaukee and happened where I grew up in Moline was that as the families got settled, made a little money, spent a couple of winters in the north, they said, man, we got to get out of here. And so they hightailed it back to Miami, where they lived for the rest of their lives. As you know, I think you talked to Ricardo Gonzalez, my friend in Madison. There was a huge influx. I think there were about 14,000 Cubans that came to Fort McCoy in 1980. They were escaping the island and the boat lift, which was referred to as the Mariel boat lift. They were scattered throughout the United States in resettlement camps. There were a lot of folks that came to La Crosse area, Sparta, and 14,000 of them. And those folks, I think it's safe to say, left the state. But some of them stayed in Milwaukee. Some of them stayed in Madison. I remember I spent 3 or 4 days at Fort McCoy with a camera crew working on a documentary. And I was, this group was very, very diverse. There were a lot of Afro-Cuban folks. There were a lot of single people. You know, if they ended up at Fort McCoy, it's because they had no one to take them in family-wise. You know, those 3 days were very exciting, very impressive, there were a few Marielitos that that have stayed in Milwaukee. There's been some caravans in the last few months, and I've met some people at those caravans who are either descendants of like kids of Marielitos or Marielitos themselves. So
you mentioned this in your previous answer, but you had talked about how in the early 60s, 80-ish families, people arrived to Mitchell International Airport. Could you talk about that history? Why did they arrive to the Milwaukee Airport?
What was happening, Miami in 1959, 1960, was, believe it or not, a sleepy little town. There was definitely not much industry in Miami. You know, I remember when I arrived in Miami, there weren't any freeways. Miami couldn't support this number of people. Mind you, there were like about 400,000 Cubans that arrived in Miami between 59 and 67, including a group of about 14,000 kids, unaccompanied kids, one of which was me, that arrived at the same time. And so the Miami economy could not support all those people. And so an effort was begun immediately to resettle, to relocate as many of those families as possible, you know, away from Miami. And the church played an instrumental role in getting that to happen. So this group of 81 Cubans that arrived on a charter flight were sponsored by members of the Catholic Church in Milwaukee.
Right at the very beginning, you said that you are a part of the Cubans in Wisconsin and Milwaukee history. How are you documenting the histories of folks for the collective?
I'm at the initial stages of my research, but I have got basically the foundation done because I happened to find a treasure trove of documents at the Archdiocesan Archives here in Milwaukee because of the Catholic family movements. And so they've got a number of scrapbooks. And I happen to know a few people who were in that first group of historic Cubans. Robert Tico Nodal came as a teenager. I think he arrived in Milwaukee in like 64, maybe 63. And so he's been able to put me in touch with some other folks who I've interviewed. In addition to Cubans, I know there's some other folks who aren't Cubans who are Latinos, who I haven't heard mentioned in the group, that in the sample that folks have spoken about to interview, and are incredibly important to Milwaukee Latino history.
How can people who are interested in sharing their families or their own personal histories as Latinx Wisconsinites, how can people contribute their stories and families' histories to this collective or to you?
You know, if any Cubans out there are listening, that particularly who are from that early group that came here in the early part of the 60s, they can feel free to drop me a line, and I'd love to talk to them and maybe interview them, definitely get some information from them, or even any documents that they might have that they want to share with the Wisconsin Historical Society. I think many of the Cubans that came became very successful. They returned to Miami and have been a very successful immigrant group. If sociologists have written a lot of stuff about the migration of the Cubans. In Milwaukee, there have been some very successful Cubans. Everybody from Marta Bianchini, who owns Cubanita's restaurant and is a restaurateur of the nth degree, to people like Jose Delgado, who died recently and helped found American Transmission Company from the spinoff from We Energies that transmitted the electrical lines across the Midwest. So we've been very successful. We've been very successful.
Raul Galvan is the manager of program production at Milwaukee PBS, and he's a part of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. at WUWM.com, you can hear our previous conversations with Ricardo Gonzalez about Fort McCoy's history receiving Cuban refugees. Buying your first home can be overwhelming. There's legal jargon, piles of paperwork, and hoops to jump through when applying for a loan. It's even harder when English isn't your first language. Take Root Milwaukee wants to help bridge that gap. The organization provides multilingual resources and goes step-by-step with community members wanting to buy their first homes. Joanna Jimenez is a program manager at Take Root Milwaukee under the Urban Economic Development Association of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in August.
Take Root Milwaukee is a consortium of different organizations, city government, real estate professionals, community organizations, lenders, and realtors that all come together to provide and promote reliable resources for people who want to become homeowners, or current homeowners who may need assistance to be able to keep their home, and also resources to help those homeowners who may need repairs done to their property.
In the state of Wisconsin specifically, there's a wide home ownership gap. The Center for Responsible Lending found that just to have enough money to save up for the 5% mortgage down payment and closing costs, it would take approximately 14 years for a Black household at the national median income level to save up for that, and 11 years for a Latino family. In comparison, a white family needs about 9 years. So what is the importance of building and facilitating workshops for non-native English speakers specifically looking to buy their first homes?
Communities of color don't always have access to the education, to the support, to the resources that can help them become financially stable to be able to make their homeownership dreams come true. I came on board about 2 years ago, and I am a bilingual. Spanish is my first native language. And so I've been using this platform to reach out to my own community and other communities that are not native English speakers to let them know that there are resources available. A lot of our agencies have bilingual, multilingual staff members that can help people who have questions, who have doubts, you know, because of the language barrier, there seems to be a little bit of a trust issue. It is important for us to be able to get the word across that there are resources, you know, that someone can pay a down payment of less than 5%, like you mentioned, but FHA is a perfect example. That's a 3% down payment. But the programs that some of our agencies have are able to help, you know, new homeowners find other resources to be able to buy a home. For example, a down payment assistance grant. The city of Milwaukee just launched one. So, you know, we are constantly putting the word out there to all communities that homeownership is affordable and definitely possible for anyone.
I'm really interested to hear about the types of specific challenges that you hear from non-native English speakers, you hear from other members within our communities of color, and you use the word trust issues. What do you mean by that? What have you heard?
You know, being from another country, you know, our culture is very important to us, right? Our language is very important to us. The way we have relationships with people, whether it's our, you know, personal relationships or professional relationships. So being able to be in the community with the people who are experiencing disparities and being able to communicate my own personal story. And I know many of our members have personal stories as well that could be empowering to someone else. You know, I'm a first generation homeowner in my family. And so that means a lot, you know, to my family. And if I can, you know, be an example for the other generations that coming behind me, right? My children, my great grandchildren, to be able to reach out to someone who you have something in common helps with those trust issues, helps to build relationship and trust. So that's what I mean about, you know, trust issues. Sometimes it's easier to speak to someone about hard things like banking in your own language.
Yeah, even in other languages, describing and explaining banking and buying a home, it doesn't make sense with all the legal jargon, in my opinion.
No, absolutely. That's something I struggled with. And so I came here to the United States when I was very young, and I had to learn English right away because my parents didn't know. So I had to help them, right? So being in school, I was able to learn English. But when I became a licensed real estate agent, I didn't know technical terms in Spanish, professional terms of a house, a mortgage, a down payment assistance, you know, so I had to educate myself, you know, and I was feeling like I was sounding like an alien, right? Like I'm speaking alien, foreign, out of space type of language, you know, when I was trying to talk to my clients. And so I had to educate myself again so that I can come across as clear and as accurate and definitely trustworthy.
I'm just wondering now too, what are some of the misconceptions and myths and just not correct or not right information that you hear from folks buying a home for the first time?
So some of the things that I can think of that may be misconceptions or myths. Number one is that homeownership isn't affordable for everyone. I think that, you know, if you work really hard at your finances, at savings, if you're frugal, if you're just knowledgeable about what resources are out here, definitely people will see that it's possible. Another thing is that with the way that the rental market is nowadays in the Milwaukee area market, it is cheaper to buy a home and maintain a home than it is to rent, just because the rent is just really, really high, right? And so a lot of people are recognizing that. And so that's what I would say, that sometimes in some markets, and you know, with everything lined up perfectly, right, it could be cheaper to own a home than to actually continue to rent. I think another one is that you need a lot of money to be able to buy a home. Like I said, there are many grants available, a lot of programs, both government and private, that will help people, you know, come up with that down payment assistance to be able to buy a home. There's even employer assisted programs to help people buy homes in specific neighborhoods.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about that. Could you go into more detail about that? How can people look to see if they qualify for that?
Sure. I mean, I would tell people to first ask their employer. If they're a major employer, most of the time they have employee assistance programs, and one of those could be a homeownership or a rent and incentive program. So I can give you an example. The Near West Side Partners organization is made up of 7 different neighborhoods, and they all have or anchor stakeholders such as Harley-Davidson, Potawatomi. Those big employers want to attract people to their neighborhood. And why not, you know, help an employee of theirs to live close to where they work? They have this program. They provide incentives for people to rent in the neighborhood that they work in and to also buy a home. So each program may be different about the amounts, depending on the availability of funds. Another example is the Haven Woods neighborhood. They have a very strong business presence in that area. And so some of those employers are helping people also buy homes within, you know, the vicinity of where their employment is. You'll never know what resources are out there, you know, if one, you don't ask or you don't research. So we do the research and it's all on our website. And the more information we can get out there, the better.
And what resources are available online, and are they available in multiple languages?
Yes. So pre-COVID, you know, we used to have in-person events. We used to have homeownership fairs where our members would come table and bring all their information. Again, we have lenders, we have real estate, we have the city government agencies, and we have community organizations that all offer resources. And so the public was able to come. We would host webinars on different topics. Some of those topics were credit, repair, savings, the home buying process. And then we would actually even have a bus tour to show people, you know, this is a house and this is how much it would cost you to pay a mortgage in it. And so, and what we wanted to do is to be in as many neighborhoods as possible. So we would do the homeownership fairs in conjunction with different neighborhoods. And some of those neighborhoods have a higher population of a non, you know, native English speaking demographic. So an example is when we did one at Bradley Tech High School, a lot of the population in that area is Spanish speaking. So we actually provided headsets for that program that talked about, you know, home ownership from beginning to end. So another thing, you know, with COVID and the pandemic, we've had to kind of pivot, you know, the way we get our message across. And so we're using social media and technology. And so we started to record our webinars to be able to have it live in our YouTube channel and, you know, people can have access to it. Whenever we put out, you know, any kind of material that speaks about foreclosure prevention, again, the resources due to COVID-19 that homeowners needed, we try to get it out there in as many languages as possible. We're always looking to partner with other organizations who primarily help people of other native languages. So again, you know, Take Root Milwaukee wants to be diverse and wants to be able to reach as many people as possible.
Joanna Jimenez is a program manager at Take Root Milwaukee under the Urban Economic Development Association of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in August. And you can learn more about Take Root's home ownership resources at WUWM.com. After the break, we'll hear from two Milwaukee percussion masters about how their craft is passed from one generation to the next. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. There's a rich tradition of Latin music in Wisconsin, including bands that have been performing for decades. In some cases, it's a family affair, with musicians not only playing music, but passing it down through generations. Milwaukee father-son duo Cecil Negron and Cecilio Negron Jr. are percussion masters in the bands Cache and De La Buena. Respectively, they're two of Milwaukee's premier salsa or Latin jazz bands. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke to them as part of our Hispanic Heritage Month conversations.
If you listen to the music of Cache or De La Buena, two of Milwaukee's premier salsa or Latin jazz bands, you'll hear a driving force, and that's the percussion. Heard them at Summerfest, in weddings, or at street festivals or lakeside performances in front of crowds of hundreds. 68-year-old Cecile Negron is the conguero or conga player for Cache. He's soft-spoken and is usually wearing his signature congol, which is like a beret with a visor he wears in reverse. His music is earnest, driving, and traditional.
My patterns are very simple, but I'm right on with the patterns of the different types of music.
One of Negron's musical inspirations is Puerto Rican supergroup El Gran Combo, who's coming to Milwaukee for Summerfest in September.
If you listen to their music, the conga player is just very, very, very easy going, but right on to the song.
Negron's trajectory into Latin percussion started in Milwaukee when he was 14 years old, living on 18th and Fleet and shopping at a corner store.
And the owner of the store always loved the Beatles. So I was just kidding one time. I said, Juan, if you love the Beatles, buy me one of those little bongos, okay? So he did.
From then on, Negron was hooked. He cut his teeth with local guitarists and started listening to the huaracha, or salsa patterns at the time, on vinyl all day long. He eventually got his first conga and started playing salsa at dances.
I think that's how I stayed out of trouble. On the east side, I was busy playing la conga.
Negron has stayed true to those rhythms, but has also moved up a bit in the salsa world.
To me, the drum is kind of my family, you know. If you come to my home, there's three congas in the dining room. And those are like the top drums, best drum that there is.
It's like having a Steinway in your living room. Steinway piano, a grand piano.
That's Cecile's son, Cecilio Negron Jr., who's also known as CeeLo. The two trade some rhythms together on two congas in CeeLo's River West backyard. CeeLo says growing up, playing the drum was in his DNA.
Not only was the drum in the house, but there were musicians that would come and be at the house. There would be rehearsals at the house. There was constant exposure to music since I was probably even before I was born, as I was being developed in my mom's belly, probably. You know, the rhythms, Latin music was just around me. It was like, you know, part of my, I don't know, my playlist for my life, you could call it, I guess.
But CeeLo was also a child of hip-hop.
I grew up when I was born in, you know, like in 75, so like 80s hip-hop, you know, that was really what I gravitated to.
He got into producing, drum machines, sampling. The mixture of old and new laid the foundation for everything CeeLo does now. That includes teaching, backing up MCs, drums and percussion of all types, and playing with Milwaukee Afro-Cuban and Latin jazz band De La Buena. So his music is an innovative spin on a variety of traditions.
It has a definitely strong rhythmic pulse, right? Because I am a drummer, and I play all sorts of drums and percussion. The Caribbean roots, right? The African roots is definitely something that's very prominent in my music. And all of the influence from my father, the roots of Latin music, all of that exposure that was given to me definitely gave me an advantage. Gave me an ear.
The elder Negron is very proud of his son's work with kids.
As far as just playing, I know that he can play, you know, out in with De La Buena or with my band. I know he can do that, but to teach, that is so hard. And teach where the student listens and learns. I think that is one of the things that I'm most proud of him.
CeeLo says his dad didn't just instill in him patterns and rhythms, but also taught him how to relate to people.
My dad is very cariño, very charismatic, very loving and very engaging, very easily to engage and talk to.
CeeLo now has four kids of his own. He's not pressuring any of them to become a percussionist or play Latin rhythms, but Grandpa Cecile is already beaming because of his 1.5-year-old granddaughter.
My granddaughter the other day brought an awesome tear of joy to my eyes because she was dancing. She was dancing to the beat of the drum of her father.
As they say, the beat goes on. Maayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Cecil Negron and Cecilio Negron Jr. are percussion masters in the bands Cache and De La Buena. They spoke to WUWM's Maayan Silver. You can find more of our coverage at wuwm.com/Hispanic Heritage. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll speak with the executive director of Milwaukee Habitat for Humanity about the city's affordable housing landscape and needs. If you missed any of today's conversations on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you're getting your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Join us again tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.